If it sounds like Montreal, it sounds like CKUT. CKUT's annual funding drive is back, and this year we're celebrating the city that made us. From Friday, March 15th to Sunday, March 24th, tune in for an earful of Montreal-made magic. Your favorite programmers will be live in studio and live streaming online for the first time ever. Tune in online, on the good old-fashioned radio, or join us in person. CKUT friends and family will be providing the tunes for an opening party at Bar La Marche à Côté on March 14th and a closing night on March 23rd at Nouvel Établissement. Stay tuned at our website for other events that put the fun in fundraising. Don't miss these celebrations of community radio and sounds of the city from your favorite local DJs. We need $50,000 to keep CKUT on the map. Powering a nonprofit radio station is more expensive than ever. Will you answer the call of your community before it's too late? Donate now by visiting ckut.ca/donate or by calling 514-907-9424. CKUT 90.3 FM, the sound of Montreal since 1987.
Hi, blessed love. This is Jimmy Cliff and you're listening to CKUT Radio. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including Toronto CIUT, Winnipeg CKUW, Montreal CKUT, and Vancouver Co-op Radio, and featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network has become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 66 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from a progressive perspective. Support the community for just $5 a month and get a new release from Between the Lines Books or Firmwood Publishing at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we expose Canada's $28.5 million in military exports to Israel on The Breach Show. Ontario MPP Sarah Jama talks about her expulsion from the NDP caucus and how Canadian political culture stifles free expression on 49th parallel. And we speak with Professional Women's Hockey League Players Association Executive Committee member Liz Knox to discuss advocating for just working conditions on the end of sport. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by the Alberta Advantage Podcast. Based in Calgary, this collective of more than 20 activists, academics, and journalists have been broadcasting award-winning political commentary, news, and analysis since 2017. On this excerpt from a classic July 2020 episode, the team returned to the 1990s to talk liberal austerity in a conversation exploring how double-digit unemployment became normalized, the influence of the business lobby, and the effects of a media-manufactured fiscal crisis with guest rankandfile.ca editor Doug Nesbitt. Now, here's the show.
The Liberals are always stealing clout. You know, they're stealing the color red, they're stealing being friends with Fidel Castro, and now they're stealing the mere concept of a red book. So I really think someone needs to put a pin in it.
Makes no difference where I go, you're the best hometown I know. Hello, Calgary.
The Alberta Advantage is supported by listeners like you. Independent, listener-supported media like this podcast is possible only thanks to the generous support of our listeners. If you think what we do is important, please head over to patreon.com/albertaadvantage and support our work with a monthly donation.
Hello and welcome to the Alberta Advantage. I'm your host, Kate Jacobson, and joining Team Advantage today, we have Roberta.
Hello.
Joel.
Hello, though.
And special guest, Doug Nesbitt. Doug, thank you for joining Team Advantage today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to do this.
So we've assembled Team Advantage today to talk about the total evisceration of the Canadian welfare state, the so-called end of history, the advent of neoliberal globalization and free trade, and the political party that did it all while pretending that they were truly progressive. That's right, we're here to talk about Jean Chrétien's Liberal Party in the 1990s, and in particular, Paul Martin's role as finance minister. I, for one, am very excited to learn about the 1990s from people who remember it and were around at the time. So to begin, let's start with a bit of general political history leading up to the 1990s so that we have a general sense of where the major changes happen.
So Liberal leader Lester B. Pearson was prime minister from 1963 to 1968, and Pierre Elliott Trudeau's Liberals were in power in Canada from 1968 to 1979, and then once more from 1979 to 1984. There was a brief little interruption in 1979 to 1980 when PC leader Joe Clark became prime minister under a minority government. And so this is really what people mean when they refer to the Liberals as, quote, Canada's natural governing party, unquote. They were in only briefly interrupted power for basically 20 solid years. Brian Mulroney's Progressive Conservatives were in power in Canada from 1984 to 1993. One particularly notable event in Mulroney's reign was the 1988 federal election, fought largely over the issue of the free trade agreement. Mulroney was deeply unpopular at the conclusion of his term, largely as a result of a recession and bringing in the goods and services tax, the GST, in 1991. He resigned as leader of the PCs in June 1993. Kim Campbell replaced him as leader of the PCs and became Canada's first woman prime minister. October 1993 saw Jean Chrétien's Liberals elected with a majority.
Leading up to 1993, a number of changes really shaped the Canadian economy through the post-war Liberal years. The post-war years were very much the heyday of Keynesian economic policy. So things like full employment or somewhat generous social programs, public funding, things like this, these were all considered normal. These were status quo ideas. Hopefully by this point, you know, it goes without saying that the way in which these were applied were very uneven across Canada and were very gendered and racialized phenomenons, but they were also ideals that governments strove towards more generally.
Well, and I think the important part about the welfare state at that point is that it's very much a universal system. It wasn't about targeted programs. It was about every Canadian receiving the same benefits as every other, regardless of income. And so it was a real difference in how we understood the sort of role of government and its social welfare policies.
The unemployment insurance program is really an amazing example of that, where I think it was in 71, Trudeau's reforms to UI brought the eligibility up to like 96% of the unemployed. And even by 1990, after years of cutbacks to it, it was still an 80% eligibility, and now it's below 40%.
Yeah, so it's maybe worthwhile to discuss like what Canadian liberalism in the 60s and 70s kind of looked like. Liberalism under Lester B. Pearson was very pragmatic and subject to pressure. What's important to note during this kind of period is that the NDP was an actual presence. They had 21 members after the 1965 election, and that, to a certain degree, can be pointed to as one of the reasons for why Pearson was kind of so flexible on the left flank. Pearson brought in the flag, bilingualism in the federal service, a new bank act, a new labor code, liberalization of divorce laws, a new immigration act, doubling of external aid, abolition of capital punishment, collective bargaining for the public service, a royal commission on the status of women, Economic Council of Canada, Science Council, National Film Board, a war on poverty, social assistance reforms so broad that the federal expenditures exceeded the nation's defense bill for the first time. There's also the Canada Assistance Plan, which consolidated all federal provincial assistance programs into one comprehensive package. In order to be eligible for matching funds, provinces would have to help people achieve and retain independence, meet financial needs regardless of cause, improve standards of public welfare, grant benefits to the working poor, and ensure national standards. Provinces could not refuse benefits on the basis of non-residency, and they could not force a recipient to accept workfare.
And then the Canada Pension Plan was originated in the late 1960s also, which it's interesting to think about now as the Alberta government is talking about taking the Canada Pension Plan and creating our own. But basically, the idea of the Canada Pension Plan enshrined several key new rights. It lowered the qualifying age to 65. We should note here that Stephen Harper raised it to 67, and then Justin Trudeau lowered it back down to 65. It also added wage-related pension as a supplement to the universal pension, so you could get both. And it declared that Canadian seniors should receive a government pension adequate to maintaining a socially acceptable standard of living rather than bare subsistence. So therefore, there'd be an automatic increase in benefits in line with increases in the standard of living. A cost of living increase? Are you crazy? And then finally, widowed or those with long-term disabilities were fully provided for under the Canada Pension Plan. And I guess I should mention also that at the same time, because federalism was a big issue in Canada, and there was a huge fight with Quebec going on, Quebec created its own pension plan at the same time and isn't under that Canada pension plan.
There was also conditions for federal grants for healthcare. So provinces had to deliver nonprofit, comprehensive, universally available healthcare to their residents, and benefits also had to be portable from one province to the other. In addition, there was also the National Housing Act of 1964, which provided loans to provincial housing corporations for public housing at reduced interest rates. This is in addition to kind of a whole suite of other things. You know, there was a youth allowance that extended family benefits to children up to the age of 18. The Department of Regional and Economic Expansion was attempting to address underdevelopment in poorer provinces. The Unemployment Insurance Act of 1971 expanded benefits and access under the program. And it actually, at the time, you know, was one of the most comprehensive unemployment insurance programs in the entire world. And at the time, it's really useful to start thinking about the emergence of basically two major camps within the Liberal Party. You've got the business liberals and you've got the social liberals. Social liberals would say have concerns about American control over Canadian industry. You know, some voices within Pearson's caucus, people like Walter Gordon, actually advocated for repatriation of the Canadian economy, saying that, you know, without control of the economy, the Canadian government couldn't maintain a commitment to full employment, which was still seen as good at the time. Foreign investment, you know, it was so high that Canadians owned a smaller portion of their productive wealth than any other industrialized country in the world at the time. And profits from natural resources, which were usually shipped unprocessed and is certainly a familiar problem, went to, by and large, foreign investors. And Gordon in particular, you know, Walter Gordon, this has encountered lots of opposition within his own party as a social liberal. And that opposition were, you know, business liberals, people who were I don't want to be super like do like crude populist terms and say like in bed with big business. But the thing is, they were literally in bed with big business. So it's difficult to kind of commit to crude terms of analysis here.
And it's important to take a measured tone when we talk about Pearson. Chomsky famously called him a war criminal. And I think that's worth keeping in mind. Also, Pearson also ended up committing himself to continental security and bilateral defense arrangements with the U.S. with Kennedy in 1963. And he tended himself to back the business liberals within his cabinet.
Yeah, everything you learned in school about the Suez Canal crisis was imperialist propaganda. So just scrub it from your brain.
One of the other things to add was in the early 60s, I think it was under Pearson, was the Auto Pact, which was basically an arrangement between the US and Canada for the auto sector, which is, of course, a huge driver of the economy at the time. So it helped secure a certain percentage of production in the North American auto economy in Canada. And that was, as we'll see, one of the big things that gets wiped out.
So that was basically the era of the 60s. Moving on to Pierre Elliott Trudeau, who won, you know, a whole handful of elections. Basically, within Trudeau's years, we saw the National Energy Program, the Foreign Investment Review Agency, the Canada Development Corporation, Petro-Canada, and the CRTC. You also saw the Orange Paper, which was a social security overhaul, which the NDP championed as the continuation of Pearson's social reforms. It was the next step in the war on poverty. It promoted a guaranteed annual income, a federal minimum wage, guaranteed employment for all able-bodied Canadians. Let's just take a second. To me, this blew my mind when I found this out that they were talking about this in 1975. Obviously, there's debate about guaranteed income, and that's for another episode. But still, they were talking about it in 1975, along with a federal minimum wage and guaranteed employment for all able-bodied Canadians. 100% employment guarantee. Phenomenal to hear about.
Well, and then one of my favorite things, as you know, is that at the same time, they're providing a steady set of tax breaks to businesses. The share of corporate taxes in national revenue declined from 17% to under 14%. And this is the period where we really start to see that shift to personal income tax rather than corporate or wealth taxes. And then, as Doug mentioned earlier, unemployment insurance really did improve during this period, but then was reduced in 1975. And Pierre Elliott Trudeau viewed the business lobby as just another special interest group. He took a bit of a different approach than Pearson had. And the business community thought Trudeau was a leftist, which I find just awesomely hilarious. Everybody's a leftist, apparently, according to the business community. And so they banded together in the mid-1970s to form the lobby, think tank network, and media outlets that would form really the neoliberal turn. Post-war liberalism was under assault everywhere in the 1970s, and so the compromise and consensus in that post-war period really broke down due to a profit squeeze and a perceived, quote, excess of democracy, because, you know, the excess of democracy.
Sometimes you just have too much democracy, and you got to just clean it up a little bit.
That was the Alberta Advantage. Find out more about the show at albertaadvantagepod.com and hear the rest of the conversation at harbingermedianetwork.com. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next. Broadcasting since 2022, The Breach Show is a bi-weekly podcast featuring sharp commentary on politics and movements in Canada. On this excerpt from a new episode, coordinating editor Emma Paling sits down with The Maple's Alex Kosh to discuss liberal doublespeak, systemic structural features, and his exclusive story exposing Canada's $28.5 million in military exports to Israel since late October last year. Here's a highlight from that conversation.
Welcome to The Breach Show, featuring sharp analysis on politics and social movements in Canada. I'm your host, Emma Paling. In just the first 2 months of Israel's war on Gaza, Canada issued more than $28 million worth of export permits for military goods that would be sent to Israel. That's more than Canada has ever permitted to be exported to Israel before, over the course of entire years. That means that as Israel's slaughter of Palestinians ramped up, there was a huge increase in Canadian companies asking to send them military goods. My guest today is the journalist who got his hands on this data, Alex Kosh. Alex is the news editor of The Maple, and despite the many, many reporters on Parliament Hill, he is the only person in the country reporting on the export permits that Canada has approved for Israel since its attack on Gaza began. Welcome, Alex.
Hi, Emma. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. So export permits are the permits that let the government regulate and control what military goods leave the country and where they go. What did your reporting reveal about the types of goods that Canadian exporters are sending Israel?
So military exports in Canada are categorized under the export control list, which I believe is part of the Exports and Imports Permits Act, if I've got that acronym correct. I know the abbreviation, it's EPA. So all military goods are filed under these things called ECL categories. And each one of these categories has a kind of numerical code. It's 2- and then another number. Unfortunately, these export categories offer only very broad strokes about the exact kinds of goods that are being sold. So for example, we saw in this list of goods that were permitted to be exported in November and December and the rest of October, there was an example of an export category which includes bombs, torpedoes, and explosive charges. This doesn't mean that everything authorized under that is actually like a missile or a bomb or anything like that. It can also include things like demolition gear or the explosive charges or components of these kinds of goods. But we know that there are about $1.7 million worth of permits which include items that fall under that category. But again, just to emphasize, we only have very broad strokes. We don't know for sure what exactly these goods are. Usually, the way journalists and arms monitoring groups understand exactly what is being sold to countries like Israel is through press releases and public statements that are issued by the arms manufacturers themselves. In many cases, for many export destinations, the companies are very happy to share that information, and they do so in public press releases. But in the case of Israel, they are much less forthcoming for reasons that I'm sure are obvious, because it attracts negative publicity, it attracts protests and complaints against those companies. But in terms of what is going to Israel from Canada, the vast majority of export permits are issued for items that fall under a category that is things like electronical equipment and software and technology. Exactly what this is being used for, though, we don't know.
But they are controlled goods.
Exactly. Yeah. These are items that are, intended for a military purpose. It can include items that are, they call them dual use goods. So an example of that might be like an engine that could be used in a civilian aircraft or also be used in a military aircraft. But in the case of electronic goods, I believe it is all equipment or all electronic items that would be used at least by a military or in a military context.
And you mentioned that the specifics about what the products actually are is not included on the documents that you got. What else was left out? What else did the government not tell you about the exports?
So the crucial information they leave out is obviously the name of the manufacturer. Really, though, it's interesting what they will sometimes disclose with these permit disclosures and what they won't. It's very selective and haphazard. So to give an example, back in December, Amnesty International Canada got hold of redacted or partly redacted permits for military sales to Peru, where there was a very violent crackdown by the state against indigenous-led protests there. Now, the permits that they got hold of didn't show when the permits were authorized by the government. All they showed was a valid from date. But in the case of these, this information that Global Affairs gave to me recently, they did tell me when the permits were actually authorized. When I asked Global Affairs about the Peru permits back in December, they told me they couldn't give me that information because of commercial privacy or confidentiality. But in the case of Israel, they decided it was okay to give me that information. So it's just entirely arbitrarily enforced rules that they use to redact information when it's convenient and when it's embarrassing, I suppose.
One of the interesting details that stuck out to me, though, in your story was the how quickly some of the permits were approved. You noted that one of them had been approved in only 4 days. So what does that suggest?
It's hard to say, and we would only be speculating, because it might just be that the goods are, you know, what the government would consider to be sort of rather innocuous, non-threatening items that don't require a lot of scrutiny and oversight. But again, that's entirely speculation. What is interesting is that according to the most recent annual report that Canada has published on military exports is the 2022 report. They come out around, I think, May or springtime. So we'll know the 2023 one in a few months' time. But in the most recent annual report that's available, they say that their target for what they call low-risk destinations for approving permits is 10 days. Now, Israel in 2022 was not listed as a low-risk destination, which is rather interesting now that we're seeing them come in, you know, well below their target turnaround time. So either they've drastically increased the turnaround time right across the board, or they may have added Israel as a low-risk destination, which would be truly scandalous, especially in the context of this ongoing genocide in Gaza.
And are there other categories? Like, is Israel categorized as like a moderate risk or a high risk, or is low risk like the only category that they differentiate?
I believe that's the only one they actually put on the report. I'm sure they have their own sort of matrix for measuring this behind the scenes. But in terms of what's in the report, they just have a list of low-risk destinations. Most of these are just other NATO countries and other allied states, I believe.
Okay. And the Liberals were not upfront about giving you this information at all. They changed their story many times over the course of your reporting. So what were they saying publicly while they were issuing these permits behind closed doors?
It's been a very confusing set of statements that we've heard from all levels of the Liberal Party. So we're talking about MPs, ministers, and the Prime Minister himself. Let's rewind back to the end of last year. So there's been a lot of protests against the MP offices of some Liberal MPs, like Julie Derevich. And in her statements to people who are protesting against her, she's appears to have confused the idea of military aid, which is what the United States gives to Israel, which is, you know, we'll take some supplies from our own defense ministry and give it to you for free, essentially. Canada does not do that for Israel. In the way that Canada does that for Ukraine, for example, we send military hardware that is donated from our own armory or that we've purchased for Ukraine, and it's shipped there directly. Julie Derevich and other Liberal MPs I've heard have been saying, oh, no, we don't send any arms to Israel, apparently confusing the idea of military aid and military exports. In a letter to her constituents, which I believe was published in January, Julie Derevich then said something to the effect of apparently realizing this distinction. Oh, right, there's military aid and there's arms sales. These are separate things. Of course, she didn't admit to confusing them, but that seems to be the subtext of this letter. But it said a really bizarre statement in that letter, and I think it's still on her constituency website, saying that I don't support arms exports to non-NATO countries. Israel is not a member of NATO, neither is Ukraine, and neither is Saudi Arabia, which is the largest single buyer of Canadian-made military hardware. I don't think that's what she meant, and I tried to ask her to clarify that, but they didn't give me a response. But what this speaks to, I think, is a confusion and a kind of ignorance, actually, within the Liberal government about what we're dealing with here, certainly among MPs. But what we're seeing with ministers who, you know, do understand these distinctions between military aid and permitting exports, they're using very careful and very selective language to mislead people, I believe. So, for example, we often hear, well, for one thing, it took a very long time for the Liberals to actually admit that any military exports were being permitted at all. I had to email Global Affairs, I think, 20 times in total to get a response on that. And even then, they only admitted it in sort of in passing. So the first thing they said to me is, we haven't authorized new permits for full weapons systems. Canada does not sell full weapons systems to Israel, and it hasn't in, I believe, several decades now. So that was a meaningless piece of information and didn't tell us anything about, you know, whether they've restricted existing exports to Israel. They eventually came around and said, okay, we've authorized new military exports, but these are all for quote-unquote non-lethal goods. Now, this is a term that has no legal definition. Canada has described items such as rifle scopes and laser range finders in its military aid transfers to Ukraine as non-lethal. Now, sure, a rifle scope isn't going to deliver a killing blow, but it is an integral part of a weapon system that does kill people. So again, this is misleading kind of doublespeak that they're using to throw people off the scent, I believe. Since we got hold of this list of export permits or the values of the export permits, this issue's been raised in Parliament, I think, three times last week, once by Heather McPherson, then by Jagmeet Singh, and then by Green MP Mike Morris. And now we're seeing that MPs in Parliament and ministers, including Trudeau and Melanie Joly, are using a very carefully scripted response saying, we have not authorized new permits for full weapon systems, period. And I get the sense now that they're kind of a bit spooked, that they've now decided, okay, we actually have to be very careful about what we say. We can't have people thinking we're selling military goods to Israel. We can say this thing that is technically true. We're not sending full weapon systems, while obscuring the fact that we are still authorizing huge quantities of military exports that allow the Israeli occupation forces to do their job, which in this case is genocide.
I think that's another interesting part of this story, that the Liberals are so publicly supportive of Israel, with a few small exceptions, like that one vote for the ceasefire at the UN, and some very weak and symbolic words about Palestinian suffering. But they seem to want so badly for these numbers to not come out. What do you make of that they wanted to mislead the public or didn't want the public to know that they're providing these arms, despite the fact that we're such an important ally of Israel?
It is very strange. I'll tell your listeners a quick story about what happened just before I got these this information about these permits. So I wasn't in my house. I was just walking around after an appointment. And I got a call, and it was an Ottawa number, and I assumed it was probably to do, I filed a lot of ATIP requests, and I assumed it was related to an ATIP request. So I answered it. And they said, this is about your request for information about military exports to Israel. We had a cyber attack back in January, which I believe is true. I've seen it reported. Can we delay your request by a few weeks? And I said, no. And they said, okay. And then the call ended. And by the time I got home, in about 20 minutes, I looked at my phone and the documents were right there. So, you know, either we're expected to believe that it took them just 20 minutes to compile and redact this highly sensitive commercial information, or they had the documents ready to go when they called me and wanted an excuse for it to be delayed. And I think the latter explanation is probably the most plausible one because, yeah, the timing of this was terrible for them. It came in the midst of the onslaught on Rafah. It comes after the ICJ has said there's a plausible case that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. So I believe it's politically motivated. I think the Trudeau government wants to kind of speak out of both sides of its mouth. It doesn't want to upset the apple cart and in terms of its geopolitical relations with Washington and Israel. But at the same time, it's trying to quiet and increasingly upset and concerned constituencies within Canada who are increasingly vocal about the need to play a role in stopping this massacre.
And it's not just with PR and these very confusing public statements that Canada tries to hide the exports to Israel, right? Canada also dodges accountability by sending goods through the United States. So last year on The Breach, we revealed that Canada had funneled armored vehicles to Saudi Arabia during its war on Yemen, which killed hundreds of thousands of people. And the Harper government was able to do this in a deal that never got reported because the vehicles were sent to the US first and then to Saudi Arabia later. Do we know whether this happens with Israel?
This is a huge kind of black spot in Canada's so-called transparency system for military exports because, yeah, that report I alluded to earlier, it only accounts for exports that go to non-US destinations. So, yeah, there was a report put out by Project Plowshares last month kind of documenting potential examples of where Canadian-made military technology is first going to the US, being fitted into F-35 fighter jets, which are then ultimately shipped to Israel and are being used by Israel right now in its attack on Gaza. So this is a huge yawning gap in the transparency system that we have for Canada's export control system. But yeah, you mentioned the Saudi exports too. I mean, something that GAC constantly says in their sort of boilerplate statements about any questions in regards to military exports, whether that's, you know, Saudi Arabia, Peru, Israel.
That was Emma Palin and The Maple's Alex Kosh on The Breach Show. Listen to the rest of the interview wherever you get your podcasts and at harbingermedianetwork.com and find more journalism for transformation at breachmedia.ca. Coming up next. Over 100 episodes from 2018 to 2021, the legendary 49th Parahel podcast welcomed listeners to long-form interviews with journalists, activists, and academics from across Canada and the international left with host Rob Rousseau in Montreal. On this highlight from a February episode, Independent Hamilton MPP Sarah Jama joins the show to talk about her censure in Ontario's parliament and expulsion from the NDP caucus, how Canadian political culture stifles free expression, and the country's bad faith discourse surrounding Israel-Palestine. Now, here's Rob and Sarah.
Great. Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm really excited to have you on here. We've been going back and forth for a couple of weeks now about trying to find a time, so I'm really thankful that we could work it out. This is really cool. I'm happy you could do this.
Thank you for having me. This is my first time on Twitch. Hey y'all.
Wow.
So I'm sorry about the lack of decoration in my Queen's Park office. I hate this place, so I haven't really invested much of like personality into it. That's why it's beige.
That's okay. It's the new office, right?
It's the same office. They didn't evict me from it.
Oh, okay.
I'm surrounded by a bunch of my former colleagues.
Oh, okay.
It's the only accessible office in the whole of Queen's Park.
Okay. So. Well, how was it going back in this new session?
It wasn't as awkward as I thought it would be. I thought it would be much more awkward. I think it's been okay so far. I was able to table my two motions on reforming social assistance in Ontario. The hallway conversations weren't as bad as I thought they would be, so.
Okay, good. Well, listen, Sarah, like, I want to talk about sort of the events of the last couple of weeks. I know you've been through a lot over the last little while, and I really want to get your perspective on that.
I do have a number of viewers that tune into this program from America, from Europe, and different places around the world. So I was wondering, just to sort of like set the stage here, do you want to just maybe introduce yourself and talk a little bit about how you got involved in politics and how you became an MPP? And then we can kind of get into what's been going on the last couple of weeks.
Sounds good. For those who don't know me, my name is Sarah Jama. I was elected in a by-election to serve Hamilton Center in March of 2023, so almost a year ago, with the New Democratic Party. Prior to that, I was an organizer in Hamilton, Ontario, focused predominantly on issues of disability justice and anti-Black racism in my community. I started off as an organizer when I was president of the McMaster Womanists on my local campus, took on carding in my community and anti-police violence, and then moved into disability justice work. I started the first Disability Justice Network of Ontario, which was youth-led and worked to basically teach disabled youth how to organize in our communities. Because I felt that disabled youth were often left out of political spaces. We're taught to ask for help instead of create the world or demand the world that we want to see and that we believe we belong in. So teaching a lot of those organizing skills to youth. I also co-managed the successful campaign of the first woman of color in my city, Councillor Narinder Nan. So I think I've done a pretty okay job at being community work, but also politically adjacent to Big P politics. And when Andrea Horvath, who was the leader of the NDP, stepped down from her Hamilton Center seat to run for mayor, my friends and I signed up about 600 new members to the NDP within a couple weeks so that I could run for the nomination and take that seat. And I got elected shortly thereafter. That's who I am. Did you want me to continue and talk about?
No, that's great. That's a great way to set the stage. I guess I was wondering, like, even before we get into the last couple of weeks, as someone that's focused on, you know, the disability justice and police violence, systemic racism, and these kinds of subjects, which I know are really important to a lot of people in Hamilton and around the country, how have you found, so like prior to these events, working within that system, within the NDP, talking about, do you think the NDP has been a good vehicle for being able to talk about these issues frankly and kind of suggesting reforms or having a critique? How has been your experience with working within the NDP to talk about this stuff up until October?
I think that's always been the question. Can you make change from within the system? We know that the system is broken. It's not fixable from the inside, but I think what I was interested in was experimenting to see if it's possible for organizers to genuinely be represented in political spaces in a Canadian sense. The Canadian system is so much, it's very different from other systems, and the left-wing parties that we find ourselves interacting with in Canada are very different from parties that say they're left-wing across the world. I think I was hoping that there would be room to do things a little bit differently, stick to principle while also pushing for major change. I think to enter political spaces in general, you're asked to give up parts of yourself, to adhere to a sort of culture and decorum that is never explicitly stated. So I find that I have broken, even before the censure, I know we're going to get into it, but I have been told I broke so many rules of decorum that were never really written down. You have to bow at a certain time to a speaker, or you're not allowed to swear when you're speaking. Your press releases have to look a certain way. You're supposed to wear blazers. I think I'm one of the few people who don't during question period very often. You're just supposed to adhere to a certain way of speaking and operating immediately out the gate when you're elected here. And nobody really hands you a rule book. and then you get looked at sideways when you don't really operate that way. So I think I was really, there was a huge culture shock, just even outside of the NDP, like in general, as soon as I was elected, because the things that people valued, like I won every poll in my riding, in the leader's riding, the leader of the party, and I'm someone with a very different politic from the leader, the former leader of the NDP, Andrew Horvath, who I replaced, and I still won every poll. Like, I think folks were excited to volunteer, to donate, to get involved in my campaign. So to have that celebrated during the campaign period, but then to be elected and scolded or feeling this unspoken pressure to follow a culture that nobody was explaining directly or willing to change was very strange. And then with the NDP, I think that culture definitely does exist too. I think one of the things that I learned from talking with Jeremy Corbyn was that the UK Labour Party at least has mechanisms for dissent within the party structure, for caucus members to disagree with each other and have difficult conversations that are explicitly stated. And then an appeal process for when things go wrong or when people are kicked out, there's processes to follow. Everything in the political space in Ontario operates through unwritten rules. And I think the NDP operates that way too. There are a lot of rules in terms of how you should function as a member of the team that aren't explicitly stated, and there's nothing to fall on in terms of rules when there are disagreements. So I think, I think things that would need to change are those sort of internal mechanisms that just don't exist, because it's kind of like operating as a fish out of water. That's how I felt after I got elected.
Yeah, and like you mentioned, I think there's a lot of people around this country, activists or whoever else, just any people that pay attention to this stuff, that is really looking for people to use their political platform to really speak unapologetically about certain issues, whether it's the police, racism, housing, or Israel-Palestine or anything like that. I mean, you mentioned Corbyn. I think he's a really interesting example. It was really kind of interesting for me to follow his rise from someone who is kind of an outlier in his own party to eventually leading the party, despite being kind of having a very different view of politics and a different view of foreign policy. And it was, I think, really fascinating for me and instructive to see the way that the sort of party establishment, even if he was the leader of the party, kind of unite against him and kind of tried to undermine him at every turn. So it shows how difficult it must be to, even when you rise to the leadership of some of these parties, in a Western liberal democracy, to actually meaningfully steer it in a different direction. And you obviously got a little bit of a taste of that as well. You mentioned prior to October 7th and like some of the difficulties you were having. And then in the days following October 7th, you put out a statement that I think for me, and I think a lot of people around this country that pay attention to Israel-Palestine, saw as kind of a breath of fresh air, where it was a statement that, in my view, was grounded in like empathy. And it was also took time to establish a kind of historical context, and it was a statement that didn't just mindlessly repeat the normal talking points we normally hear in these kind of moments about Israel's right to defend itself, which across the political spectrum we hear time and time again, over and over, no matter what Israel's actually doing. So I thought that was a really incredible thing. I think a lot of people around the country did, and the political establishment that you're a part of, even inside the NDP, didn't really view it in that way, I guess, would be a nice way of putting it. Do you just want to talk a little bit about what happened during that period, those few days, and how you came out with that statement and your experiences afterwards?
Yeah, for sure. Before I even get into that, I think it's important to say, like, even during my campaign, a lot of the right-wing media came after me relentlessly. Like, there were articles written day after day after day because of my support of Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights on my campus. Like, I supported the BDS movement on my campus, getting passed.
Living on the road, my friend, what's gonna keep you free and clean? Now you wear your skin like iron, and your breath's as hard as kerosene. You weren't your mama's only boy, but her favorite one, it seems. She began to cry when you said goodbye and sank into your dreams. Well, Pancho was a bandit, boys. His horse was fast as polished steel. Wore his gun outside his pants for all the honest world to feel. But Pancho met his match, you know, on the deserts down in Mexico. And nobody heard his dying words. Oh, but that's the way it goes. And all the federales say they could have had him any day. They only let him hang around out of kindness, I suppose. And Lefty, he can't sing the blues all night long like he used to. The dust that Pancho bit down south ended up in Lefty's mouth. The day they laid poor Pancho low, Lefty split for Ohio, where he got the bread to go. Oh, there ain't nobody knows. And all the federales say they could have had him any day. They only let him slip away out of kindness, I suppose. Well, the poets tell how Pancho fell and left his living in a cheap hotel. The desert's quiet and Cleveland's cold, so the story ends, we're told. Pancho needs your prayers, it's true. Save a few for Lefty too. He just did what he had to do. And now he's growing old. A few great federales say they could have had him any day. They only let him go so wrong out of kindness, I suppose. A few great federales say they could have had them any day. They only let them go so wrong out of kindness, I suppose.
Someday when we meet up yonder, we'll stroll hand in hand again. In a land that knows no part. Sometimes I don't know where this dirty road is taking me. Sometimes I don't even know the reason why. But I guess I keep a gambling, lots of booze and lots of rambling. Well, it's easier than just a waiting round to die. All one time, friends, I had a ma, even had a pa. Well, he beat her with a belt once, cause she cried. She told him to take care of me, headed down to Tennessee. Well, it's easier than just a waiting around to die. Came age and I found a girl in a Tuscaloosa bar. Oh, she cleaned me out and hit it on the sly. Well, I tried to kill the pain, I bought some wine and hopped a train. Seemed easier than just a waiting around to die. Then a friend said he knew where some easy money was. We robbed a man and brother did we fly. But the posse caught up with me and drug me back to Muskogee. And it's 2 long years of waiting around to die. Oh, but now I'm out of prison, I got me a friend at last. He don't drink or steal or cheat or lie. Oh, his name's Codeine, he's the nicest thing I've seen. Well, together we're gonna wait around and die. Yeah, together we're gonna wait around and die.
Tears. and I think I'm gonna miss you for a long, long time. 'Cause I've done everything I know to try and make you mine. And I think I'm gonna love you for a long, long
That brings us to the next part of the story, right? Because once the CWHL folded, you were basically in this position, you and I mean all of you, all the athletes who worked in that league, you had the choice of potentially joining what was at the time like the competing NWHL, or, and I think that this was a really a fascinating part of the story, right? Because my understanding was, so many of you felt that the problems that you've experienced in the CWHL, they were replicated exactly in the NWHL. And what you rightly demanded, basically, was that professional athletes in women's hockey deserve to have the kind of working conditions that any professional workers and professional athletes deserve.
That was a highlight from the End of Sport podcast. Find the more than 120 episode archives wherever you get your podcasts and at harbingermedianetwork.com. This episode of Harbinger Showcase has been brought to you by the Alberta Advantage. Find out more about Calgary's number one podcast at albertaadvantagepod.com. Subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for weekly updates on new episodes from Canada's cross-country community of more than 60 socially and politically progressive podcasts. And support our work for as little as $5 a month. We'll send you a free new release from Between the Lines Books or Fernwood Publishing. Find out more at harbingermedianetwork.com. Music on this episode's courtesy of Creative Commons. Stay tuned for another episode of Harbinger Showcase on this station next week. I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
Well, and I think one of the things to emphasize is, you know, I mentioned that the business community forms this lobby and this network. And I think it's really important to stop for a second and think about how it's influenced the world that we live in, that the business community really sets up all of these organizations and these groups to start promoting their message in all the different venues that you might think of. So the Fraser Institute, for example.